Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by John Anderson, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer from the band Yes, of course, as you know him. But we're talking because you have a new solo album out called A Thousand Hands. It comes out July 31st, so pretty soon here. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Excellent. Good to hear you. Good to hear you, Jason.
Where are we talking to you from? Are you in London, or where are you?
No. I'm Central California for the last 30 years. I'm in halfway between L.A. and San Francisco, up in the hills, away from the hustle and the bustle of the local village.
Nice. So let's talk A Thousand Hands. What's in a name? You know, tell our listeners why you called it A Thousand Hands, you know, honoring everyone you've worked with on this over the years.
Yeah, I think that was it. How many people I've known in my lifetime that have influenced me? I actually wrote out on my Facebook one time, and I got up to about 300 people that really influenced me in my life, musical people, artists, dancers, all sorts of people. And when we were doing this album originally, I just wanted to add different musicians on that I'd met in my travels. And the more I thought about it, I thought I should call the album Uzlot, which means a lot of us. And then when we started 28 years later, we started finishing the album in Orlando, and the actual producer, Michael Franklin, suggested, why don't you call it 1,000 Hands? It means a lot in China. And I said, well, that sounds pretty cool. Why not?
I agree. It does sound pretty cool. Wait, so you just mentioned, did you really start working on this solo album, you know, like 20, 30 years ago? Has it really been that long?
Yeah, I was, I'll try and keep it short, the story. I was in L.A. My friend there was Brian Chatton, and Brian Chatton was in my first band, The Warriors, in the 60s. And he joined The Warriors when he was 16 years old, and we kept up our friendship all these years. And he just happened to be in L.A. at the same time as me. So I asked him to write some music for me. I need some songs, some music for songs sort of thing. And he gave me a cassette of ideas he had. And I went up to Big Bear, which is southeast of L.A. It's a big ski resort. And I went up there to just relax and get away from the world. And I had a 16-track recorder. So I started writing these songs. And Brian came up with a couple of friends, Keith Hefner, great keyboard player, and Gary Barlow, great musician. And so we just hung around and did some great tracks. And then I had to go on tour in 1991. So after about 3 months in the mountains, I went on tour with Kitaro, a famous Japanese composer. And Brian Chatton went on tour with B.B. King. So everybody split up for a long time, and we didn't realize it was going to take 28 years for us to start putting the album back together. And Michael Franklin, the producer in Orlando, he got in touch with me and said, I want those tapes that you have from Big Bear. And I said, oh gosh, they're in my garage. I'll send them to you. And he got the big tapes. These are big 24-track tapes. And what you have to do is put them in the oven and bake them. And so they'll only play once because it's all just tape. And it goes straight to computer. And Michael sent me the songs. And I said, hey, they sound great. All we need to do is put some really talented people on, and it'll make it really good. That's what we do.
I love it. I love that, you know, you stayed committed to making that and brought it back around all these years later. Tell our listeners about, you know, how the various songs on the album span different sorts of styles. You know, you have some acoustic, but you have some reggae pop, you have some funk. Well, I'll let you say it so I can use the soundbite. But tell us all the different sort of genre styles that you had mixed in here.
Well, we had definitely six songs from the mountains that we really loved. And, again, they were, you know, classic sort of. See, I write as though it's Yes for some reason. That's my idea of music is Yes music. And I've done a lot of different kinds of solo albums, very ethnic, very world music, Native American energy music, that kind of thing. Because, you know, music is such an adventure. So basically, we got to a point where Michael Franklin knew so many musicians in and around Orlando because they work at Universal or Disney World and all that kind of thing. And he just got, he got Chick Corea to play on a track, and then Billy Cobham and Jean-Luc Ponty played on a track, and all these people came and played on the music. So the music sort of evolved, and we were just sort of short of about three songs. So I sent him some of my vocalizationing, which I do every day. I have this energy to sing every morning. I love it. And it's sort of chanting in a way. And it comes from a video I saw years and years ago about these pygmies in West Africa. When they go out hunting and foraging, they just sing beep and bop, beep and bop, kind of energy. And the insects and birds sing along with them. And it's kind of extraordinary. So I sent Michael Franklin a couple of these 3-4 minute ideas. And he just added some incredible straight from, actually, he actually recorded the music for Rama Lama and Where Does Music Come From on a plane ride from Orlando to China. Because he goes to China all the time. And it's, so it's amazing how in these days you can have all those incredible sounds on a computer, and you just, you know, mix them into the vocals that I've done. And that's why we have such an array of ideas on the album.
Wow, I love it. And the new single is called Firstborn Leaders. Explain to our listeners how, what it's about, you know, how, you know, mankind's next phase of enlightenment that you see. Explain that.
Well, in some ways, it reminds me of the 60s when I really, I was a hippie, I still am, and the world was changing so drastically in the 60s, and it's just like it is now in 2020. I didn't know it was going to be like this year, but that's what it is. The whole world is changing on many levels consciously, and so the song Firstborn Leaders are the people that really woke up in the 60s. They have children and grandchildren now, but we are the sort of firstborn leaders of a higher principle of life and a love of life and make love, not war, and things like that. So,
nice.
So the song is all about, the introduction is that, and then the song is all about how many different kinds of people that I was meeting in Big Bear. And I wrote down their names and sang about them. And that's what that track is about. It's a good, fun track to do on tour. But I keep forgetting the names, so I have a cheat sheet in front of me every time I sing that song. And I still cannot remember all the names, which is crazy.
Well, that song good. Sort of that song sort of charts, you know, mankind's phases of light in my mind. But let's talk about your story a little bit. When you were, you know, tell our listeners where, you know, where you grew up and, like, you know, how, what sort of music did you listen to growing up? What was your sort of stuff?
Oh, boy. Well, you got to go back, you know, I'm 75 now, you see. So when I was a kid growing up, I was listening to big band of the 40s. And then in the 50s, we had this thing called skiffle, which actually was American-born early rock and roll. And there was a guy in England called Lonnie Donegan. I think he was Irish. And he would play the skiffle music, which was from America, and that evolved into rock and roll. And, of course, I was so into the Everly Brothers, because me and my brother Tony, who's about 3 years older than me, we would sing all the Everly Brothers songs, and then he would sing Elvis Presley, and I would sing, you know, whoever I could sing. And then all of a sudden the 60s came, and we had a band called the Warriors, and you know, me and my brother went to see the Beatles before they became famous. Kind of incredible story. We went to see the Beatles in a place called Southport, about 20 miles north of Liverpool. And they just had this single, Love Me Do, on the radio. So Tony, very, very smart guy, so let's go see them on his motorbike. And we went there. And it was amazing. And from that moment, I wanted to be a Beatle, just like thousands of young guys, you know, and there wasn't any screaming until at the end of each song, so you could actually hear the band play, and it played amazing. And then 7 months later, we went to see them again in a local town near Manchester, and we couldn't hear them because everybody was screaming all the way through.
Well, that's great. You got to see him before it became deafening. You mentioned you had you mentioned your influences and how you had a band called Warriors in the '60s. How did you transition from that, and how did you actually form Yes in 1968?
Gosh, how long have you got?
The short version.
here's the quick version. I was with the Warriors, and we were on tour in Germany, and the guys in the band wouldn't get out of bed and rehearse. I had some crazy ideas to do musically, so they kept telling me to go away. Not as polite as that, but just get go away, John, every morning. And I said, okay. And I packed up my bags, and I went to London. And I was working in a bar above one of the famous clubs in London, which was the Marquee Club. And you'd have The Who playing there. You'd have, the Small Faces with Rod Stewart was singing in that band. Jimi Hendrix would play there. And they'd all come up to the bar before the gig and after the gig. And I was working in the bar cleaning up and serving a bit, but just generally cleaning up. And one day, the owner of the bar said, you've been looking for a band. There's a guy over there looking for a singer. And he was this tall guy, just me and him in the bar about 6 in the evening, and it was Chris Squire. And he had a band called Mabel Greer's Toy Shop. And I said, the name's a bit too long for me. We should be called something short, Eventually we called ourselves Yes. But the following day I went with Chris to his band, and we started rehearsing ideas, and I had so many ideas for songs. Most of them were pretty famous songs anyway. We actually did a couple of songs from West Side Story, but we jazzed them up, rock and roll jazz fusion. We had a drummer called Bill Bruford, and he was very jazzified, So we developed our style over a period of about 3 years before we really hit the big time with Roundabout, which was our third album. We had a song on that called Roundabout, and that was the song that really helped us, and obviously Fragile, and then Close to the Edge. So by the time 4 or 5 years had passed, we were pretty famous around the world, which was kind of amazing, because you never think it's going to happen to you, but it did.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned Roundabout. Unpack that a little bit for me. Do you remember, how that song came together, writing it or arranging it?
Oh, boy. Well, we were in Scotland. We were up in Aberdeen, the north of Scotland, and we were driving down to Glasgow, and the road down to Glasgow was this beautiful ride, just a two-lane roadway, and there must have been about 25 roundabouts on the way down, and it was about 200 miles trip, and me and Steve Howe, he had a guitar in the back of the van, and we started writing a song. And I saw these mountains coming out of the sky because you couldn't see the top of the mountains because of the clouds. And then we go past all these Loch Lomond and all these lakes in and around the lake. And in 24 hours, we're going to be back in London. And that was the idea of the song. And we wrote most of it on the way to Glasgow. And we recorded it 2 days later in London. It's kind of amazing.
That's really cool. Well, you have, gosh, so many songs and so many albums we could ask you about, but it would take forever. But I know my listeners would kill me if I don't ask you about Owner of a Lonely Heart. I mean, it's probably your most iconic. Real quick, similar to how you just dipped around about, how did Owner of a Lonely Heart come about?
Okay. It was like the beginning of the 80s, and I was in the south of France, and I started writing music about this beautiful guy I met. He was a great 90-year-old artist from Russia, called Mark Chagall, and I started writing songs for him and thinking of a musical about his life and things. And then I got a phone call from Chris. John, are you coming to London? I said, oh yeah, I'm coming next week. He said, well, I want to speak to you when you get there. And I thought, well, I haven't seen Chris for 3 years. I said, why not? We'll get together. We're all brothers. We might not understand each other half the time, but we're musical brothers. So he came to my house in London. And he had a Rolls Royce, and so we sat in his Rolls Royce, and he played me these tapes. And they were really, really very interesting. They're very, very different, very sampled music here and there, very, very well produced, was beautiful. and they were going to be called Cinema. And I said, this is a great album, Chris. I've got to go now. He said, no. Would you be interested to sing on it? And I said, well, yeah, but I think, you know, this song, Owner of a Lonely Heart, the chorus is great, but the song is a bit boring. Why don't you just do a staccato, like, move yourself, get out of your life, come on, or else you'll be Owner of a Lonely Heart, sort of thing. And he said, come on tomorrow to the studio. And so I said, okay. On the way, I said, you know, we're going to be called Yes. He said, yeah, well, that's what we want. I said, well, that's okay. So I spent, a couple of weeks singing all the parts and rearranging sections and putting my sort of musical stamp on Owner of a Lonely Heart. I wrote the verses with Trevor, the first verse, and the producer, Trevor Horn. He watched me as I wrote the next verse and the middle bridge and everything. The chorus was always Trevor Raven. You know, it was always a hit record.
Oh, I love it. Those are probably the two biggest hits that, you know, folks of all generations have heard round about Owner of a Lonely Heart. But do you personally have one that you've always thought, you know, a song or an album that you thought was underrated, like one of your personal favorites that maybe never got the acclaim that you thought it deserved?
Well, actually, there's a couple, but it's a funny life, you know, because by the time we did Owner of a Lonely Heart, you know, I was probably 35 years old, I think, 36 or so. And I thought I was too old to be a rock star, pop star, whatever. So I really never made albums writing pop music, if you like. Except I tried one in the 80s when I was famous, more famous. The record company gave me a lot of money, gave me a check and said, so what are you going to do? Are you going to make a record? I said, yeah, I'm going to go to Cuba. I'm going to sing with the big bands in Cuba because they're amazing, which is very true. So they stopped the check and they said, no. If you're going to do an album for us, you know, Arista Records, you've got to do it with maybe a producer we know. He's just been producing Simply Red. He knows who you are. He likes you very much. He knows Toto, one of the great bands of all time, who are session musicians. And you could actually make the album with the session musician called Toto. And I said, okay, we'll do that. And it was a really, really good album. I actually wrote with a very famous songwriter called Lamont Dozier. Now, Dozier comes from Holland, Dozier, Holland, who were writing all the Motown songs of the 60s, 70s. Incredible writers. So we wrote two or three songs one afternoon at his house in the Valley in L.A., and one of them was Hold On To Love. And I thought, this is a hit record. I definitely think this is a hit record. And it never was, except it was a big hit record in Quebec for some reason.
You never know, right?
I went up to Quebec to do a solo show. I love doing solo concerts, just me and a guitar. And they invited me up to a festival, and I went up there. And I got to the gig, and the management was around the corner of the festival, and I went to the office, and they're playing my song, Hold On To Love. And I said, you don't really have to play it. Don't worry, you know, because, and they said, what do you mean we don't have to play it? We love it. This was a top 10 song. And I said, oh, fantastic. Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Sorry, somebody's calling me. I think I have to go.
That's okay. We appreciate all your time, and congrats on getting inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That had to have been a good feeling.
It was a lot of fun. I did shake a lot of hands. It was incredible. I wish you well, Jason.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Good luck. It's called 1,000 Hands, everyone. Check it out July 31st. Thanks, John.
Thanks, man. Take care.